I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this is Hashtag History,
the podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike,
where we dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption.
This is Hashtag History. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And we are so excited to bring you this bonus episode, not only because of the topic we are covering, which is something I have been thoroughly obsessed with for a very long time now. Like, seriously, actually obsessed. This is the topic that I spoke about in my junior college communications course, because I'm a weirdo like that. But we're also super excited. Yeah, like, really nerdy. Because we're talking, like, when I went to junior college is, like, 10 years ago now. And we used the projector was like an old school projector where you had to lay, you know, an image down on the screen. And I had images of bloody bodies to project on the screen for people. Anyway, the other reason we are super excited about this episode is because we have an awesome guest on the podcast this week. I could talk for a while about how excited I am about our guest, how I first came to know our guest, why our guest is awesome. And trust me, I will. I'll be going into all of that. But first, Ian, I'm going to let you go ahead and introduce yourself. Tell our listeners who you are and a little bit about you and your podcast.
Thanks for having me on. That was I'm very humbled by that that intro.
Oh,
no, you should be like hyped up by it.
Yeah, so I'm Ian from Necronomipod. It's a podcast, serial killers, cults, aliens, ghosts, all that fun stuff. And I do it with my two best friends, Mike and Dave.
And then you also have another podcast that I listen to.
Yes. I have one called Promised Land about the Jonestown incident. It's on episode 9 right now. I think it's going to go like 12 episodes.
It's really, really good.
Thank you.
Really good. So for my own little personal introduction to you, Ian, so Necronomipod was one of the many new podcasts that I found during quarantine. It was actually my husband that found you guys, and he told me I had to listen to you right away. He heard about you guys on Reddit, which is where he spends like 90% of his time. And he read on there about the Nexium episode, and he said I had to listen to it because after he listened to it, he said I was going to learn something I didn't already know. Which for me, I've listened to nearly every podcast about Nexium. I've watched all the documentaries. I've read all the books. I even listened to Catherine Oxenberg's audiobook, which was fantastic because you got to just listen to her beautiful accent the entire time. So I was like, I'm like, yeah, sure. Okay. Necronomipod's going to be, they're going to teach me something I don't already know. Okay. You actually did.
What was it?
It was so, yeah, I'm going to tell you, and it's pretty outrageous. One of the great mysteries to me about Nexium was how exactly Nancy Salzman and Keith Raniere met in the first place.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So for anyone that doesn't know and is also equally obsessed with Nexium, what I learned from you guys was Nancy Salzman was constipated.
Yeah.
And Keith Raniere was operating like a supplements club or something. So she went to him to relieve her constipation. And thus, Nexium was born. So I have to tell you, all the material that I've consumed about Nexium, I had never heard that before. And my husband knew immediately that that tiny little detail would hook me on Necronomipod. So Nancy Salzman's actual literal shit is what got me hooked on your podcast.
That's awesome. Yeah, that was that's an odd detail about that. That cult.
And it's amazing with how much I have consumed about it. I had never heard that before. It's something that I felt like was glazed over because I was like, how do we not have an origin story of these two people, how they met and how this whole thing got started? And it was your podcast that educated me.
Yeah, it's literally a like pyramid scheme supplement company she tried to get something from.
Did it help with the constipation, though? Do we know?
I don't know. Maybe she kept coming back to him for stuff.
So. So in all seriousness to our listeners, you all know how important thorough and accurate research is to me. And that's what I find over and over again with both of your podcasts, Ian. You hands down have some of the best well-researched podcasts out there. And I think...
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. I think we cover a lot of similar topics and we overlap a lot. Mm-hmm. So I'm always super impressed when I listen to an episode of yours where you cover the same topic that we did, but you hit on all the small, little known details, and when you share things that I didn't even learn in my own research.
Right.
Yeah.
Tonight's subject, I have no clue. I knew nothing about this when you brought this up.
Really?
That makes me even more excited.
Yeah. My mind immediately went to February 14th, 1999, WWE's pay-per-view for called St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Yeah, I can't relate to that.
I'm like, yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about was that the whole time.
Yeah. My co-host Mike was like, you should just hijack the whole show and just start like putting out the history of that pay-per-view event, like all the matches, all the stuff.
Leah and I would have been sending each other very awkward text messages the whole time. Like,
like, do you want to stop him? Or should I?
Let's pretend like our audio is all messed up and we accidentally drop the call. Yeah. But anyway, so I highly recommend Necronomipod to all of our listeners. It's so well researched, but you all do it in a really entertaining way. I laugh and learn with every episode, and my husband and I, between the two of us, Necronomipod is almost always playing in our house. So I always have your voice in my house.
I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. So having said all of that, we're super excited to have you here and to have you join us in telling the crazy, tragic story of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Yes. Thank you, Ian. So I'm going to start off on a little bit of the background of Chicago and the gang scene that was taking place there, just to give our listeners a little bit of like a setting for this horrible story. So gang warfare certainly was the norm in Chicago during the late 1920s. A chief gangster, Al Capone, who I will do a very, very, very short overview of in just a moment. He sought to consolidate control by eliminating his rivals in the illegal trades of bootlegging, gambling, and prostitution in Chicago. You see, Prohibition made millionaire celebrities out of gangsters like Al Capone and turned the nation's, and especially Chicago's, justice system into what I can only describe as a burning dumpster fire of corruption. But people tolerated the situation because the gangsters were their direct line to getting that illegal schnapps, you know? They got alcohol from these gangsters, and for the most part, the violence was generally of the gangster-on-gangster variety and didn't really overtly concern the general public, at least not in any personal way. So, Al Capone, aka Scarface, was the leader of a gangster unit operating in Chicago during the 1920s, known as the Chicago Outfit. Born to Italian immigrant parents in New York City, Capone joined the organized crime business in his mid-teens, working his way up to eventually become, quote, mob boss by the early 20s. I feel like I'm going to have to watch Goodfellas after this.
Yeah.
My husband's going to make me. Over about 7 years, he expanded the then relatively small bootlegging business by increasingly violent means. But despite this, was considered almost like a Robin Hood figure to the Chicago community. Oftentimes, he would donate to Chicago charities, and he was kept safe by his mutually beneficial relationships with like the likes of the chief of police, Mayor William Hale Thompson, and other city leaders. So again, you have citizens and city leadership alike looking the other way while Capone and his cronies continuously increased their violence and expanded their power over Chicago. Now, again, this is just a brief overview of Capone. You all know we could talk about him for ages. Yeah. I think Rachel is especially obsessed with him.
And maybe we should. Maybe we need to end up doing an episode about him. We've talked about him, I feel like, in at least three of our episodes now.
Yeah, for sure. But in the context of the event we're discussing in today's episode, consider this a Sparks Notes version. Do you guys remember Sparks Notes?
Oh, yes.
I've never even heard of Sparks Notes before.
It was like Cliff Notes. But for poor people, in me.
I'm like, Sparks Notes is what got me through college.
Yeah. I'm not reading that novel. Sparks Notes.
Yes.
So, like you were saying, people were looking the other way while Al Capone was ramping up the violence, and he had control of the South Side. But then there was a guy named Bugs Moran who had control of the North Side, and these two hated each other, and it was very, very public. It's said that a lot of Moran's hatred towards Capone had a lot to do with the fact that Capone started a prostitution ring to make more profit, and Moran was Catholic and refused to get into any of the prostitution stuff.
I love when these gangsters have morals like that, right? Like, I refuse to give into the sex industry. However, I will shoot you and kill you for stealing my whiskey.
Yeah, a lot of them have that odd sense of morality in certain situations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At the time, a guy named Earl Jaime Weiss was the head of the Northside Gang. He was known as the only man Al Capone feared. Moran was high up with the Northside Gang and was running a bootlegging operation of alcohol with Weiss. And that bootlegging was a real threat to Capone's rival bootlegging operation. And the Northside Gang was pushing into Capone's territory, like pretty aggressive from what I was reading. This started a turf war between the gangs that started to come to a head when Johnny Torrio's gang killed a Northside Gang member named Dean O'Banion. Moran and Weiss attempted to assassinate Torrio, which failed. And Torrio was, from my understanding, was like Al Capone's mentor.
Yeah.
I'm sure you know way more about that than I do, but that's the little bit I saw.
Yeah, I can confirm that information.
So, yeah, they put out a hit on Torrio, but that failed. And so they moved on to Capone. The Hawthorne Inn was Al Capone's headquarters. And when they figured out a time Capone would be there, they tried to assassinate him by firing over 1,000 bullets into the inn and a restaurant nearby that Capone went to a lot.
That's insane. 1,000 bullets. 1,000. That's insane.
It's crazy that that police and stuff are willing to look past that.
Oh, totally. I mean, I kind of touch on it later, but bribery from gangs, you know, to law enforcement, that's nothing new here. Like that's right. Commonplace. It's crazy. Welcome to the Prohibition era.
It seems like 1,000 bullets would probably make somebody be like, hey.
Yeah, it's... You know, when you hear like late at night, like a sound and you're like, was that a shotgun? And it's like a single gunshot.
Right.
With like 1,000, you can't really deny. You know, like, yep, those were most certainly gunshots.
Then moving on to October 11th, 1926, Weiss was shot and killed by two gunmen ordered by Capone in retaliation for that whole 1,000 bullets thing.
That little old thing. That thing.
This effectively put Bugs Moran as the head of the Northside Gang. As the rivalry between him and Capone continued to escalate and Moran kept trying to take over the South Side, Moran decided to avenge Weiss's murder by putting a hit out on a Capone associate named Jack McGurn. Moran wasn't successful in killing McGurn, but this kind of, at least from my understanding, seemed like a last straw in this long battle for turf and the whole bootlegging alcohol stuff. By this time, it was 1929, and Capone was living with his family in Miami, Florida, to get out of the Chicago winter. McGurn went down to Miami to speak with Capone regarding the ongoing problems with Moran and the fact that Moran tried to have him killed.
I have to pause for just half a second. Just the mm-hmm. level of money where you can move in accordance with the seasons. I want to get out of the Chicago winter, so let me just move to Miami for the winter.
Have you ever been to Chicago in the winter?
Yeah, I know. You went in like February,
I would
right?
Anything to get out of Chicago in the winter. There was actually, I think it was the first U.S. case was in Chicago, and I happened to go to a conference there in February 2020. And it was just a nightmare. Nobody, obviously, at that point was like wearing masks or anything. Nobody was really overtly concerned about it. But all I do remember about Chicago is that I was flying back and meeting Rachel in Disneyland directly from Chicago. And my flight was delayed because of a snowstorm.
Yeah.
And I just remember having a panic attack because the next day I was supposed to be in Disneyland and I wasn't about to waste a $300 Disneyland ticket. so yeah, that was a very stressful day of travel for me.
I've never been to Chicago, but we get a lot of snow here in Cleveland.
I'm not a snow person.
Nope. As Sacramento, California girls, at least I'm speaking for myself here, freak out when it's below 75. Like below 75 is bothersome. But we also get our summers are like, it's not abnormal to have a 115 degree day in Sacramento.
It was, yeah. I think it was almost 90 today, right?
Uh-huh. In April.
Like in the mid to high 80s, yeah.
I was like in the 50s here today, raining, kind of cold.
The best part about people that live in kind of colder weather is how y'all like when it's 65, you're wearing t-shirts and shorts like it's the summer.
Oh, yeah,
and
for sure.
Like in 65, we're still wearing our thickest coat with a scarf and a beanie.
Yeah.
So Capone agreed to McGurn retaliating against Moran. And with that, McGurn started to plan how this was all going to go down. McGurn figured out where Moran's headquarters was, which ended up being a garage behind the SMC Cartridge Company at 2122 North Clark Street. He hired gunmen from outside the Chicago area, so if anyone survived this attack, they wouldn't be linked back to Capone. McGurn also had lookouts set up at an apartment across from the garage and got a hold of a stolen police car and two police uniforms to use as a disguise. After everything was organized, McGurn told a local alcohol hijacker to contact Moran on February 13th, 1929. The hijacker was to tell Moran that he had gotten a shipment of Old Log Cabin whiskey, which he was willing to sell for $57 a case. Which
was a steal.
I guess, yeah, it was like really cheap.
Yeah.
So Moran agreed and told the hijacker to meet him at the garage at 10:30 a.m. the following morning.
So now, of course, I have to be the one to speak to the actual massacre because, like, blood and guts is kind of my thing. So like Ian already mentioned, George Bugs Moran was one of Capone's greatest rivals. Moran ran his operation out of a garage located at 2122 North Clark Street on the north side of Chicago. Moran rented out this garage. It wasn't like a hangout spot or anything. It was a storage place for the bootlegging operation. So because this was not necessarily a hangout spot, the assumption is that the gang was meeting here for a very specific reason. Like Ian mentioned, it is assumed that they were lured here with the promise of stolen whiskey at a price that was just too good to be true. Which, like, hi, when something's too good to be true, it's usually not true. just public warning. I've actually uploaded a picture here for us to check out of the garage. It was actually really difficult to locate a picture of the original garage since that garage has since been torn down and turned into a parking lot. But let's go ahead and check out the picture.
It looks not like a garage to me. It looks like a tiny little storefront or something.
Yeah, when I think of garage, I think of being able to put a car.
Yeah. like I'm not sure how cars got right in here.
Yeah. Yeah, I cannot explain that, but it is like right behind, like you were saying, Ian, that cartridge company, and I do feel like it is pretty well hidden. Like I wouldn't necessarily think that this was where a bootlegging operation was going down.
Mm-mm.
So, it's February 14th, 1929. Moran's Northside gang had met at this garage. There were seven men in the garage at this time. Six of them were gang members, and then there was also a mechanic that worked for them named John May. Moran himself was running late and had not yet reached the garage. In fact, it would later be learned that Moran and another gang member, Ted Newberry, were approaching the garage minutes after 10:30 a.m., and they spotted a police car outside, so they left and hung out in a nearby coffee shop instead. At about 10:30 a.m., four men entered the garage, two of them wearing police uniforms, while the other two wore trench coats and hats. Eyewitnesses later reported that they saw these four men pull up in a cop car before entering the garage.
From all accounts, it doesn't appear as though the Northside gang was particularly concerned about these visitors. Seeing cops, the typical response of the gang was to play it cool and then offer money. Like we already shared, bribing cops is an old pastime of the Prohibition era. The four men told the Northside gang to line up against the wall, and then they took away their guns. The four men then opened fire on the Northside gang. Because it's going to come up later, two of the weapons used were Thompson submachine guns. So for anyone that's not super into guns, hi, hello, me. This is the stereotypical gun that you envision when you think of the Prohibition era. It's a fully automatic rifle that's lightweight and easy to get around with. So it became a favorite of the mafia during this time period.
Is it the one that has like, it's like a little round cartridge where all the bullets are?
Yes. It's exactly what you envision.
Like the guy from Home Alone when he's watching the gangster movie in Home Alone. Yes. Oh, that's what I picture.
That's exactly it.
That's the first thing my mind goes to.
Yeah, totally. These Thompson submachine guns also went by other names such as Tommy Gun, Chicago Typewriter, the Tommy Boy, Chicago Style, and more. 10 seconds and 70 rounds later, all seven men were gunned down. And the images from the scene are brutal.
Part of me wonders if, like, it was only how many rounds? 70 rounds as opposed to the original.
What was only 70?
Only 70 rounds, guys. So it wasn't like a full retaliation.
Not quite so aggressive. Shortly thereafter, eyewitnesses said that they saw the two men dressed as cops lead the other two men dressed in trench coats out of the building with guns to their backs. This is super fascinating. As an eyewitness, I think it's very clear what this looked like, right? It looked like a bootlegging raid. When the actual cops arrived, they found that one man, Frank Guzenberg, was still alive, despite the fact that he had been shot 14 times.
Go Frankie.
That's crazy.
He was rushed to the hospital where he was questioned about who was responsible for the massacre. His response, no one shot me. Which, like, you literally have 14 bullet holes in your body. So, but okay. He died only 3 hours later without revealing any information. One other account that I read, it does say that Guzenberg did reveal that it was cops who had gunned them down, but he refused to say anything more than that. Capone was instantly suspected of orchestrating the massacre. It's assumed that Capone had a lookout, like Ian mentioned, that possibly misidentified one of the gang members for Moran and had signaled the shooters to enter the garage. The only survivor of this heinous attack was the mechanic's dog, Highball, who was there to witness the whole thing.
Aww.
I know. Okay, now Ian is about to take things back over to discuss the investigation and to dive deeper into the theory that Capone was, or maybe was not, behind the massacre. But before he does that, I just need to address one thing. Part of why the St. Valentine's Day massacre was so sensationalized was because of the way it was portrayed in the media and the pictures that were plastered on the front covers of newspapers. The pictures are really, really disturbing. If you just Google them, you can see them now. And that's coming from me, someone that's all up in the true crime, dark history scene. They're very gruesome. Pictures on the front covers of newspapers of bodies strewn across a room with blood all over the floor simply are not the types of pictures that we would see on the cover of newspapers today.
I saw a picture of them lined up like afterwards, like after it had been, their bodies had been moved and they were all like in a row.
Yes. I thought you were talking about, there's also a picture of men actually standing up, lined up, and that was like an investigation that they did later. They like restaged the event.
This picture, you could clearly tell that everybody was dead in the picture.
Yes. And then there are pictures that were taken even before they, you know, adjusted their bodies, where, I mean, just imagine the position your body could potentially be in if you had been gunned down like that, you know, kind of like all sideways, right, with blood everywhere. Brutal.
So obviously, like, with how big this was, the massacre was all over the news. And the public full well knew that Capone was behind this. Investigators recovered shells and bullet fragments from the floor of the garage and organized them into evidence envelopes. The Cook County coroner decided to take like a newer scientific approach to investigating the massacre. he brought in Dr. Calvin Goddard, who at the time was the first credible and leading specialist in the field of ballistics testing. Like, this was going to be the first big crime that ballistics was used on.
Forensic files stuff.
So Dr. Goddard was able to prove that no two revolvers were made exactly alike, that every weapon makes characteristic marks on a bullet and a cartridge shell. So he was like the first guy to figure that out.
That's fascinating.
And the part that I thought was really interesting, that the ballistics will be the same every time they're fired on a gun. Like, it never changes. Mm-hmm. He also found that out, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Fascinating.
So he tested bullets and shell casings that were recovered from the crime scene. And he confirmed that two Tommy guns confiscated from a house in rural Michigan were used in the massacre. But this didn't end up leading to any solid arrests or trials, anything like that. Like I said earlier, Capone had been living in Miami at the time, so that was a solid part of his alibi. But he was also called in for questioning in Miami by the Dade County solicitor on the day of the massacre, so he had the perfect alibi. Capone was called to court twice regarding the massacre, but he claimed to be sick both times, which for whatever reason that worked, he was just never called back in again.
Oh my God. I wish I could get out of jury duty that way.
McGurn, who orchestrated this whole thing, he was charged for the massacre, but was never brought to trial. McGurn had what became called a blonde alibi, where he said that he had been at a hotel room with his blonde girlfriend, Louise Rolfe, from 9 p.m. on February 13th. Through 3 p.m. on February 14th.
Sounds like a good night.
Doesn't seem like the greatest alibi in the world, but it worked.
My God. So how did this incident change things for Capone? Mm-hmm. Like I said, prior to this horrific incident, Capone and his cronies were sitting... Why do I keep calling them cronies?
Do it. Do it. Lean into it.
Capone and his cronies were sitting pretty, and they certainly weren't, quote, flying under the radar. In fact, they were flying way, way above it. They were granted the benefit of a certain level of fame for their crimes and were almost viewed, like I said earlier, kind of like a Robin Hood figure in Chicago, making money illegally, but donating some of it to charitable causes. But the slaughter of seven men, photos and all, proved to be too much for the public to overlook anymore, and it flung Capone and his crew into the national spotlight and into the sights of then-President-elect Herbert Hoover. In the wake of the St. Valentine's Day massacre, the publisher of the Chicago Daily News, Walter A. Strong, joined by Frank Loesch of the Chicago Crime Commission and Laird Bell, attended a secret meeting at the White House with newly elected Herbert Hoover. In Hoover's 1952 memoir, the former president reported that Strong argued, quote, Chicago was in the hands of the gangsters, that the police and magistrates were completely under their control, that the federal government was the only force by which the city's ability to govern itself could be restored. Unquote. Hoover's presidential campaign centralized around criminal justice, so the pleas of Strong and his affiliates was the last push he needed, and he was more determined than ever to clean up the mess in Chicago. He wanted to make an example of Capone, the nation's most notorious gangster and the man widely believed to be responsible for the St. Valentine's Day massacre. And so began a multi-agency attack on Capone. The Treasury and Justice Departments developed plans for income tax prosecutions against Capone and his followers, and a small elite squad of Prohibition Bureau agents, whose members included Elliot Ness, were deployed against bootleggers.
This is always and forever the most fascinating piece of Capone's story. It's just the charges that end up bringing him to justice, because they cannot definitively prove he did anything else.
I find it so interesting. It's like, okay, we can't get him for this, so instead let's get him for
tax evasion,
tax evasion, or there's a number of other charges which I'm gonna go into a lot of detail on, so my apologies if you're not interested in hearing all of the things that he was charged with.
So interested.
So in a city quite used to corruption, these newly arrived lawmen were incorruptible, to the devastation of Capone and his crew. It seems their plan was to arrest Capone for any and every crime they could pin on him. So between March of 1929 and September of 1930, Capone was arrested for contempt of court in Chicago because he had feigned an illness to avoid an appearance, which apparently is a regular thing for him.
Amazing.
Carrying a concealed weapon in Philadelphia, he picked up vagrancy charges in Miami and also was smacked with perjury charges for making statements that the Miami police refused to feed him or give him water and threaten his family during his stay in jail there. And finally, in September of 1930, Capone was arrested again on charges of vagrancy in Chicago this time. And then in February 1931, was tried for his earlier contempt of court charges. He was sentenced to 6 months, but remained free while on appeal. On March 13th, 1931, Capone was charged with income tax evasion for 1924 in a secret grand jury, which would end up being his ultimate demise. You see, after his brother was arrested and sentenced to 3 years in prison for tax evasion in 1930, Capone ordered his lawyer to regularize his tax position. He was being like, really like, I don't want to go down for what my brother went down for.
Yeah.
So during the negotiations that followed, his lawyer stated the income that Capone was willing to pay tax on for various years, admitting income of $100,000 for 1928 and 1929, for instance. There was other instances of this. And so without any investigation, the government had been essentially handed on a silver platter a letter from a lawyer acting for Capone conceding his large taxable income, which he did not pay.
Oh, wow. Fascinating.
Capone was indicted by a federal grand jury on 22 counts of income tax evasion from 1925 through 1929. He was released on $50,000 bail, but a week later was indicted on 5,000 violations of the Volstead Act, which is prohibition laws.
5,000.
Yeah. In June 1931, Capone pled guilty to the charges of income tax evasion and the 5,000 Volstead Act violations as part of a 2.5-year prison sentence plea bargain. The deal was later thrown out, though, and so the trial ended up proceeding. Capone was convicted of 5 counts of income tax evasion on October 17th, 1931, and was sentenced a week later to 11 years in federal prison. He was fined $50,000 plus $7,692 for court costs and was held liable for $215,000 plus interest due on his back taxes. His contempt of court sentence was served concurrently. As we discussed in our Alcatraz episode, Capone served his time first in an Atlanta penitentiary, which I like to imagine it's the one they were in The Walking Dead, because that took place in Atlanta.
Yes.
So I'm just pretending. Okay. But eventually he was moved to Alcatraz, where he still benefited from his underhanded deals with guards and wardens. Remember that photo of his jail cell that looked legit like a 5-star hotel room? Like, he had carpets and rugs.
And yeah, and porch and stuff. We actually said we would pay to stay in that cell. I very distinctly recall us saying that.
Yes. While imprisoned, he was diagnosed with syphilis of the brain and spent the last months of his imprisonment in the hospital wing of Alcatraz. Due to his decline in health, Capone completed his term in Alcatraz on January 6th, 1939, and was transferred to the Federal Corrections Institution at Terminal Island in California to serve out his sentence for contempt of court. He was paroled on November 16th, 1939, after his wife May appealed to the court based on his reduced mental capabilities. So, really steep decline of this once very high and mighty mob boss.
Yeah, sharp decline.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like a 0 to 100
for sure
kind of decline,
or 100 to 0 would be a better description.
So the next piece of our episode, Ian's gonna kind of cover like ghosts and paranormal activity in the area of the massacre, correct?
Yeah, and I feel like I'm gonna be a huge bummer with this because there really isn't what I thought there was going to be for hauntings with this.
Bummer. When I was putting together our initial outline for this episode, that kept coming up, that there had been like paranormal activity there. And that was something, it's something I know nothing about. So even if you tell us two sentences, it's more than I've ever learned.
I thought it would have a lot more because, so like 2000, like mid 2000s, that horror movie came out. I think it was just called St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Oh, I don't watch horror movies, so I don't know.
It was all hyped up. Like it was 3D in the theaters.
Oh, yeah. Did you see it?
Dave's gonna yell. Yeah, Dave's gonna yell at me though if I got the name wrong. He's gonna listen to this and judge me. So where the garage, I think you brought this up earlier, but like where the garage used to be, it's just an empty lot now, and there's a nursing home and an apartment complex across from it. Like people said that they heard like phantom gunfire and guys yelling and stuff like that. Back when, like the week after it happened, people were saying that, like, there's accounts from back then, and then it just kept going throughout the years. It's always with like the phantom gunfire or hearing guys screaming or something.
Perhaps there really is gunfire and real people screaming. Perhaps we should consider that option.
There's this guy named Ken Melvoin Berg. He is the co-owner of Weird Chicago, which it does like these tours around the city.
Oh, cool.
Like going to weird places like John Wayne Gacy's old house.
Oh my god.
Well, it was torn down, but they like drive past the street and stuff.
Sign me up.
They take people here to the empty lot, but this guy says it's not haunted. He's never talked to anybody that actually, you know, experienced anything. But they still take people there and
make money.
Do the whole thing. Yeah. And then Ghost Adventures did an episode on it.
I didn't know that. I used to be obsessed with Ghost Adventures, but I haven't watched them in several years.
Yeah, and that's clearly all fake with that show. So
yeah, which is why I stopped watching them.
Yeah, there's not a lot of ghost stuff. I was kind of bummed out about that. You know what? The other thing that I did read about it, the brick wall is said to give people bad luck, like people that stole bricks out of it and stuff and took them home with them.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, that's actually the coolest thing that I read as far as like paranormal or anything like that would be concerned. Didn't read any accounts of like what type of bad luck people got, but supposedly people got bad luck from those bricks.
Like from taking the bricks out of the wall, you said? Like,
yeah, like when it was torn down.
Oh, okay.
Like people were taking the bricks like as a souvenir kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. That's morbid.
Well, actually, we're just about to jump into the really morbid stuff about this brick wall. So,
okay.
Yeah. So like I shared earlier in the episode, the garage located at 2122 North Clark Street, it was torn down in 1967. Like you just shared, it's now a parking lot, and you'll find no plaques or signs or statues or anything in the area commemorating the spot of the 1929 massacre. Much like the three of us, or I guess I'm just assuming here that we all feel similarly, there was this morbid fascination with this location and a desire to preserve the history of it. Before the site was demolished, a Canadian businessman named George Patey swept in, and he paid for 414 of the bricks that lined the brick wall that the seven men had been lined up against before they were viciously murdered. He attempted to tour with these bricks, like, you know, going to like malls and museums and stuff, but he was banned from places because there just wasn't an audience for something so violent.
I'm just imagining, yeah, like who would pay money to look at a brick wall?
Well, and it's like not even a brick wall. Weird. It's bricks. Like, you want to see my bricks?
Oh, so gosh.
He faced the same problem again when he attempted to open a crime museum where he could display the bricks there, but the country, fresh off of the John F. Kennedy assassination, the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, the Malcolm X assassination, and the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination, just was not, there was not a market for it at that time. He ended up having the bricks put into a 1920s themed nightclub in Vancouver called the Banjo Place. This is so ridiculous. The bricks were placed in the men's bathroom with a plexiglass covering where men could aim at the bullet holes in the bricks.
That's super weird.
Also, I do not want to be the janitorial staff that comes in there afterwards. The nightclub closed not too long afterward. Patey sold some bricks here and there, but they were, for the most part, acquired by the Mob Museum in Las Vegas, which looks super cool. And initially, I was thinking I want to add this place to my bucket list, but if even looking at the bricks gives me bad luck, maybe I shouldn't. But I did upload a picture for us to check out of that brick wall.
In the picture, there's like, I don't know, there's like actual, is it still blood on there?
Yes.
That's crazy.
And then you can see like circles where the bullet holes are. Morbid stuff.
Yeah. Morbid stuff.
Morbid stuff.
That's the same, those are the same bricks that were put in the bathroom at that place?
yeah, are they?
I have a point to bringing that up.
I mean, I believe so because they were put in the nightclub, in the men's bathroom, and that nightclub closed. Right. And so the bricks were then sold to the, I mean, he sold like some here and there, but the majority of them were acquired by the Mob Museum.
So if there's any truth to that bad luck stuff with the bricks, those ones probably have real negative energy coming off of them.
Yeah. And also urine.
Yeah. Just that whole thing.
Ian, you said you've never really heard of this at all before this?
I mean, I knew kind of what it was, but I literally had no idea it involved Al Capone or any of it, really. I didn't know much about it, so it was cool. It was fun to read into it.
I will say I didn't know most of the details. All I did know about it was that it was somehow connected to Al Capone.
Okay.
But now I know more. Thanks for teaching me new things.
Like I said in the beginning, it's when you said St. Valentine's Day Massacre, my mind immediately went to a cage match between Stone Cold Steve Austin and Vince McMahon. So
you're like, really? They want to cover that?
Yeah, and then I touched on at the top of the episode, this is something that I've just been fascinated by forever and ever. Like during my communications course in junior college, when other people were speaking about, because you could speak about whatever you wanted for like our final speech, and people were talking about like yoga and their families and their pets. And I talked about the St. Valentine's Day Massacre and projected pictures of dead people up on the whiteboard. So that's me in a nutshell.
What grade did you get?
What grade do you think I got? I was a 4.0 student.
A plus.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to this very special episode of Hashtag History featuring our new friend Ian from, I cannot say this by the way, I'm really impressed, Rachel, with how quickly and easily you say it, Necronomipod. Was that right?
Necronomipod.
Like, you know, the Book of the Dead?
Yeah, the Necronomicon. No, like necromancers. Yeah. I got it. That's really hard for me to say.
If you came to this episode because of Ian, because of Necronomipod, because of Promised Land, and you're not familiar with the Hashtag History podcast, thank you so much for joining us. And you can join us right here every Tuesday where we drop stories of history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption.
And you can also find us on our website at hashtaghistory-pod.com or on Instagram at #history_podcast. And then, Ian, do you want to share with our listeners your social media handles and where our listeners can find you?
Yeah, everything is at Necronomipod. And then for Promised Land, it is at Promised Land Cast.
You mean no one took Necronomipod on social media?
Nope. Everything was available for that.
Shocker.
Well, thank you so much again, Ian, for joining us. This was super fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Of course. Bye.
Bye.